Today, Moving the Cliff, the DFA Daily to the 8th of July 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a touch of philosophy on the side. The banks are deferring loans for longer, but only on a selective basis. And there are warnings that some households may need to consider more drastic action if household finances have taken a more permanent hit. The ABA says that as customers approach the end of their six-month loan repayment deferral period, Australia's banks will implement a new phase of support to assist customers to get back to making their repayments. In this next phase, customers who can start repaying their loans will be required to do so at the end of their six-month deferral period. In the long run, it is best, they say, for the financial well-being of individuals, families and businesses to return to full loan repayments and pay off their debt. And of course, it's best for the banks too. Those who are able to repay their loans will resume doing so, which is in the best interests of those customers and allows support to be directed to those who need it. Encouragingly, many customers have already chosen to resume making repayments, said ABA CEO Anna Bligh. Customers with reduced incomes and ongoing financial difficulty due to COVID-19 will be contacted as they approach the end of their deferral period to ensure that wherever possible they can return to repayments through a restructure or variation to their loan. If these arrangements are not in place at the end of a six-month deferral, customers will be eligible for an extension of their deferral for up to 4 months. Customers will be expected to work with their bank during this extra time to find the best solution for them. A deferral extension of up to 4 months will not be automatic. It will be provided to those who genuinely need some extra time. Many customers may need less than 4 months to either restructure their loan or get back to full repayments. Banks will work with customers to find the best options to restructure or vary their loan. Options may include extending the length of the loan, converting to interest-only payments for a period of time, consolidating debt, and a combination of these and other measures. If during or at the end of any deferral, customers continue to be severely financially impacted and are unable to make repayments, they will be assisted through their bank's hardship process to determine the best long-term solution for their individual circumstances. This, they say, is a distressing time for many Australians, with over 800,000 deferring their repayments through this crisis, and around 500,000 of those are mortgage holders. To meet demand, banks have deployed over 5,000 extra frontline staff who will proactively contact and work with customers to find the right solution, but be patient with bank staff as we enter this next phase, they said. This next phase of bank support will avoid a cliff for customers in September and give them the breathing space they need to work with their bank and get back on their feet financially, said Ms. Blythe. Australia's banks supported their customers as the country entered the COVID-19 crisis, and they're determined to support their customers on the way out of the crisis, she said. In relation to credit reporting, for customers who recommence repayments on their existing loan or enter into a new repayment arrangement, their credit report will not be impacted, provided they meet the new repayment arrangements. If you are granted an extended deferral period approved by your bank, your credit report will not be affected. As banks continue to support their customers through the difficult impacts of COVID-19, they will act in accordance with the guiding principles of the Banking Code of Practice. In particular, they will communicate with customers in a clear and timely manner, act with honesty and integrity, and treat customers in a fair and ethical manner. The banking industry has together developed the next phase of support following discussion with APRA and ASIC to provide the appropriate regulatory treatment. This agreement has been reached pursuant to the interim authorisation granted by the ACCC and implementation and is subject to notification to the ACCC. And this from CBA. Commonwealth Bank of Australia today launched the next phase of its support to help customers whose finances have been affected by the coronavirus crisis to progressively return to full mortgage and loan repayments. Following the start of an intensive three-month check-in with affected customers about their individual financial positions, many retail and business customers have resumed paying in full or in part their loans, which were placed in deferral at the start of the pandemic. As more customers restart their loan repayments, CBA will target its support to those people who need it the most. This move is underpinned by a new agreement with the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, which will allow customers to keep their loans in deferral for up to a further 4 months on a case-by-case basis, depending on their individual circumstances. The additional deferral will also have no impact on a customer's credit report or their credit rating. CBA Chief Executive Officer Matt Commons said, "We are committed to continuing our industry-leading support for customers and businesses to help them get back on their feet and inject vital financial stimulus into the Australian economy. While many customers are doing better than we expected, we know that some customers will require further support, and we will contact them over the coming months to discuss the options that might be available to them. To date, our coronavirus measures since March 2020 have provided about $15 billion in direct financial support to customers and stimulus for the economy. Supporting customers who continue to experience financial difficulty is a priority, and we are tailoring our support to make sure such customers get the advice and assistance that would suit them." Since the beginning of the pandemic, CBA brand has provided loan repayment deferrals for almost 130,000 home loans and supported 100,000 business customers. The bank's financial support has reached over $15 billion to businesses and retail customers, including $9 billion of support to 100,000 businesses, repayment deferrals requested on 260,000 loans, and home loan repayments reduced to minimum, releasing up to $3.6 billion to Australian households. And they've approved over $760 million of new lending from over 8,400 applications under the government's SME guarantee scheme. And customers aiming to restart home loan repayments can choose to make minimum repayments, switch to interest-only payments for a specific period, or fix some or all of their loan on an all-time low of 2.29% for 1, 2, or 3 years. CBA has also more than doubled the size of its financial assistance solutions team to about 1,500 frontline staff to have conversations with our retail customers experiencing hardship, they said. The bank is also using its unique machine learning technology to identify individual customers in hardship and direct their support where it is most needed. "This next phase of our support reinforces the strong collaboration and effective cooperation between federal and state governments, regulators, and the banking industry, which has allowed so much to be achieved in such a short time," Mr. Commons said. And APRA came out today and said they'd announced an extension to its temporary capital treatment for bank loans with repayment deferrals, as well as temporarily adjusting the capital treatment of loans where terms are modified or renegotiated or restructured. On the 23rd of March 2020, APRA announced that banks that offered borrowers impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic an option to defer repayments for a period of up to 6 months need not treat the repayment deferral period as a period of arrears for capital adequacy and regulatory reporting purposes. APRA will write to all authorised deposit-taking institutions this week advising that this regulatory approach will be extended to cover a maximum period of 10 months from the start of a repayment deferral or until the 31st of March 2021, whichever comes first. APRA's expectation is that ADIs grant new or extended loan repayment deferred arrangements after undertaking an appropriate credit assessment to ascertain if an extension or new deferral is appropriate for the particular borrowers given their circumstances. APRA will also provide an adjustment to the normal regulatory treatment of loans that are restructured. Where an ADI restructures an affected borrower's facilities before the 31st of March 2021, with a view to putting the borrower on a sustainable financial footing, the loan may continue to be regarded as a performing loan for capital and regulatory reporting purposes. Given the volume of deferrals, APRA considers it reasonable to provide ADIs more time to determine the best approach for each borrower. While some customers are able to return to making normal payments in the near future, for others, it may be preferable for an ADI to restructure or renegotiate the loan to provide a revised repayment schedule. And in some cases, banks will need to recognize that loans are permanently impaired. APRA Chairman Wayne Byers said these measures are designed to incentivize ADIs to continue to support their customers through an extended period of uncertainty, while at the same time facilitating the restructure of eligible loans in a measured and timely manner. We are fortunate, he said, that the Australian banking system has the balance sheet strength to be able to provide ongoing support to customers temporarily impacted by COVID-19. This will help to avoid unnecessary hardship and foreclosures and allow the banking sector to work with its customers to find the best solutions to manage their debts. ADIs are expected to have a comprehensive plan that demonstrates how they will systematically work through the large volume of impacted customers, as well as avoiding operational constraints as deferral periods come to an end. And to maintain transparency, APRA will also require ADIs to provide regular disclosures regarding the status of their deferred, restructured and impaired loan portfolios. And APRA also intends to publish monthly aggregate data on the extent and nature of loans currently subject to repayment deferrals. And APRA has also consulted with the Australian Securities Investment Commission, ASIC, to confirm these measures are compatible with ADI's obligations to customers, and APRA will actively supervise the implementation of these measures and continue to engage with industry to support impacted customers and facilitate the recovery of the Australian economy. Meantime, Westpac says that the shutdown in Melbourne has altered their growth profile for the Australian economy, and they have slightly lowered their annual forecast for 2020 from a contraction of 4% to down 4.2%. They retain their forecast of growth in 2021 of 3%, recognising that this shutdown will represent a permanent loss of activity out to the end of 2021 in the order of about $3 billion. And they've been forecasting a 1.5% growth for GDP for the December quarter to be followed by 2% in the December quarter, but following the 0.3% contraction in the March quarter and their forecast of 7% contraction in the June quarter, they have expected a 4% contraction in GDP over 2020. Yesterday, the Victorian Premier announced a full shutdown of Greater Melbourne for 6 weeks in response to the recent wave of coronavirus infections. This area covers around 20% by population of the Australian economy. For the purposes of our forecast, they say, we expect that other parts of the Australian economy will be disrupted, particularly around the New South Wales borders, regional Victoria, and interstate travel, which adds a further 5% of the economy to be affected. So we're forecasting that the Australian economy contracted by 7% in the June quarter, and hours worked contracted by 9.5% in April and fell by a further 0.7% in May. So although we have not yet seen hours worked data, any recovery in June is likely to be very mild compared to the collapse in April. Accordingly, for Melbourne and the other areas discussed, the base from which to calculate the impact of the latest shutdown is still going to be quite weak. Say that the recovery through June is 1.5%, proxied by, say, hours worked, then the economy relapsed to shutdown pace, so they can argue a 1.5% contraction over the next 4 to 6 weeks is likely. So if we look at the September quarter for Melbourne and the regions, a contraction of 1.5% over the next 6 weeks is forecast to be followed by an expansion of 1.5%, equivalent to the reopening effect we assess for June over the second half of the September quarter. That means that while we forecast, they say, 75% of the national economy will grow by 1.5% in the September quarter, the other 25%, centred on Melbourne, will stall. And that reduces their growth forecast for Australia to 1.1% in the September quarter from 1.5%. But they caution the unknown variable will be the impact on the national confidence of this unexpected development. That will arguably depend on whether there is a relatively quick outbreak in the virus elsewhere. Given that the original source of Victoria's outbreak has been attributed to the management of overseas returnees, scrutiny across the country around the international borders and visitors will be intense. For the December quarter, our base case, they say, is 2% contingent on no further significant shutdowns and a sustained reopening of Melbourne. And note, they say, earlier this week, around the fiscal outlook, we factored in some constructive policy responses, including that JobKeeper and JobSeeker are scheduled to terminate at the end of September, and for this December quarter, they are forecasting an extension of JobKeeper for around a third of the current 3.3 million recipients, and the reduction in JobSeeker payments of around $300, not the currently budgeted $550 per fortnight. With Melbourne showing a degree of pent-up demand, they say we expect that Melbourne and regions, 25% of the economy, will grow by 2.7% in the December quarter compared to 2% for the rest of the country, and that implies overall GDP growth of 2.2% for the December quarter. And overall, our original forecast of a 4% contraction in the Australian economy in 2020 has been downgraded to 4.2%, with a somewhat weaker September quarter to be followed by a stronger December quarter. As discussed, the events in Melbourne highlights the risks to this scenario, they say, around the containment of the virus, other shutdowns, and the inevitable savage loss in confidence that will occur. And they're also forecasting a budget deficit in 2021 of $240 billion, up from $170 billion. Remember the promise of a surplus? And that includes the reforecasts for extensions to JobKeeper and JobSeeker. And the conversation made the point that the reimposition of Stage 3 restrictions on metropolitan Melbourne is, as Victorian Premier Dan Andrews said, a matter of life or death. That's also true for small businesses. A further 6 weeks of stay-at-home orders for the city's 5 million residents will kill off many small and medium-sized businesses unless there are critical changes to federal and state government assistance policies. Even with assistance, many will not survive. But ensuring those that are viable are not lost is crucial to the recovery of both the Victorian and national economies. Small businesses are the engine of economic growth. They are typically the first to innovate and respond to economic changes. The abnormal economic shock wrought by the necessary public health response to the COVID-19 pandemic means that they have generally been hit the hardest. Without policies and money to address their core needs, this second wave of restrictions will be a killer blow. These fundamentals are absolute to the success of small business. First, and most obviously, they need customers. Those providing essential local goods and services, such as grocers or health services, may cope, but those offering discretionary goods and services, such as hospitality, will suffer both from loss of foot traffic and suppressed consumer spending as people save more in uncertain times. And second, they need access to credit. This is much harder for small businesses to obtain than large businesses with assets. Small businesses are typically started by entrepreneurs who finance their endeavors with their own savings through mortgaging their homes or taking out personal loans. They typically have extremely limited cash reserves to ride out tough times, and many juggle their bills from month to month to stay afloat. Third, they rely on momentum. They grow by acquiring both customers and knowledge of their market. When repeat business stops, they lose that momentum. If they have to shed employees, they lose business knowledge, which sets them back even further in their recovery. All economic slowdowns typically reduce demand, but this health and economic crisis has calamitously damaged all three aspects. The federal government's JobKeeper program and subsidies being provided through the Australian Taxation Office to boost business cash flow has enabled businesses to hold on to employees for now, but without customers or credit, even extending these measures beyond their scheduled September 30 end won't be enough. It will in fact take 3 to 5 years for consumer confidence and spending to return to pre-COVID levels, they said. This assessment is based on past recessions where high unemployment prevailed, compounded by the novel problem that health fears will suppress consumer confidence long after the coronavirus is contained and things return to normal, or at least a new normal. The Melbourne outbreak of COVID-19 underlines there is no quick fix to the COVID-19 crisis. The only light at the end of the tunnel is a possible vaccine, which might take years or never be found. The economy must therefore adjust, and not all businesses are viable. To continue indefinitely to pump public money into direct grants to prop them up is unsustainable. To do so will lead to perverse consequences, providing windfalls to businesses that would have failed anyway, as many small business ventures do, while providing adequate support to those that are important and would have survived but for the crisis. Therefore, the conversation says, I offer three suggestions. First, continue JobKeeper and tax offices cash flow boosts for as long as COVID-19 restrictions are in place. Businesses would need to apply for this on a month-by-month basis and need to meet set criteria. Second, the government should ensure easy access to low-interest loans for the next 2 to 3 years. Loans are more efficient than direct grants or subsidies. The fact that loans have to be repaid will encourage only those businesses with a good chance of being sustainable of seeking them. And getting a loan is slow and hard for small businesses because banks scrutinise them due to the risk. Few small businesses have the skills to prepare the extensive documentation banks require, and banks will be motivated to lend faster and do more business if governments remove the risk by buying these loans. And to speed up the lending application process, there should also be subsidies to licensed financial advisors to prepare those applications. And third, a system of subsidised vouchers for financial management advice from accountants and financial advisors, who are mostly small businesses, by the way. Financial services are critical for small businesses in tough times. It might be tempting to dispense with these services, but sound financial advice will be critical to business owners making the right decision, including whether they should be borrowing money to sustain their business or making the hard decision to cut their losses and move on. And Roy Morgan Research says that consumer confidence fell to an 8-week low. In fact, confidence declined 1% last week following a 4.6% fall the week before. There was a small improvement in the financial conditions sub-indices, with current finances gaining 0.7% and future finances up 1.9%. But economic conditions weakened further, with current economic conditions declining 2.2% and future economic conditions falling 2.7%. And in addition, the time to buy a household item fell by 3.1% following the 4.9% decrease last week. Inflation expectations was stable at 3.2%, which is the four-week moving average. I think that we should expect more falls ahead given the COVID situation. And finally, CoreLogic in the US, which owns the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, released its monthly home price index forecast based on the Case-Shiller data. After years of being bullish about home prices, CoreLogic suddenly has turned bearish with regard to US prices. It forecasts that prices of single-family houses, including distressed sales, would begin dropping on a month-on-month basis with the June reading, and it's just released its May reading, which was up 4.8% year-over-year, and that prices as tracked by the National Home Price Index, the HPI, will be down 6.6% year over year by May 2021. 2021 will mark the first year that home prices are expected to decline in more than 9 years, CoreLogic said. The last year-on-year decline in the HPI was booked in January 2012. Strong home purchase demand in the first quarter of 2020, coupled with tightening supply, has helped prop up home prices through the coronavirus crisis. However, the anticipated impacts of the recession are beginning to appear across the housing market, the report said. The recent surge in pending home sales and in purchase mortgage applications to levels above June last year, supported by record low mortgage rates, continues to exceed expectations despite the severe recession. This was driven by pent-up buyer demand after the spring season was embroiled in the lockdowns and spring demand moved into summer. But by the end of summer, under pressure from the unemployment crisis, buying will slacken, and they say we expect home prices will show declines in metro areas that have been especially hit hard by the recession. And by May 2021, the National Home Price Index is expected to be down 6.6% from May this year. All states are expected to experience a decline. The CoreLogic Market Risk Indicator predicts that 125 metro areas have at least a 75% probability of price declines by 2021. The Case-Shiller Index, which does not include distressed sales, sees disappearing gains in 2021, but no actual price declines. The HPI forecast, which does include distressed sales, sees a fairly steep decline, roughly in parallel with the first segment of the year-over-year price declines during the housing bust. The impact of distressed sales becomes apparent during the housing bust, during which the HPI, which includes distressed sales, plunged more sharply than the Case-Shiller Index, which does not include distressed sales. And CoreLogic sees some particularly bad vibes for states like Arizona and Florida that are now confronting elevated COVID-19 cases and the subsequent collapse of the spring and summer tourism market. This perfect storm would curtail home purchase demand over the coming year. Now, in summary, I just want to come back to the events today with regards to kicking the can down the road. We knew there was a cliff in September. The banks basically have extended that cliff further out, but they have been more rigorous this time in terms of which people will be able to access those extensions. And the fact that they are now talking about having individual conversations with customers, frankly, flags, I think, a concern about rising distressed sales later in the year. And mirroring what we saw in the US, if that's true, that will put further downward pressure on home prices across Australia. The fact of the matter is, if households' income profile has fundamentally changed thanks to COVID, and it's not a quick bounce back, as I think probably most people would now agree it's not, then those loans are not serviceable, those properties need to be sold, and that four-month period will probably lead to a significant rise in distressed sales. The question, of course, should be whether people in difficulty should move quickly to sell before prices fall further, or whether they should wait and hang on and hope that somehow things turn around, incomes improve, and they can stay in their properties. That, frankly, is the dilemma now, that more than a million households, according to our analysis, will have to face. And that takes me to my last point. Not everybody in financial difficulty has been able to negotiate loan repayment extensions with the banks. And that includes a lot of property investors. And my own view is that it's the property investor segment that will go first, as I discussed in my live show yesterday. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.